We have a lot coming at us as parents, and I want to talk to you about how to take advantage of the opportunities and moments we have. Poor guy, can you even see me? This music is coming. Music stands in the way. Well, anyway, to set the stage for this, you maybe have seen this on television or at a circus. You ever seen the guy that grabs a bunch of plates and puts them on sticks and spins them? I've always wanted to do this. And on. There you go. I've always wanted to do this with someone else's plates. And but you know, the guy that spins the plates, you know, he put one on there, he gets it going, and he adds and then adds, and the first one starts to wobble and all. He's just going over like a crazy man. Well, that reminds me so much of our lives, doesn't it? I mean, we all have so many plates that we're spinning. I mean, you got a plate, let's say, of your marriage, and you got a plate of your job, you got church, you got friends, and you got all these plates, and you're spinning them like crazy, and you keep adding more on. But the cool thing is there's an app for this. You see? And so we have these highly sophisticated lives because we have software that helps us keep our plates going, and we think we're just so cool. And then some of these come along. These are children. And you get these children amongst the plates, and these take a lot more wrist action to keep them going smoothly, if you know what I mean. I mean, you're just going after them all the time. So you got your plates, and you got your saucers, and you're going crazy. But then you think, okay, I think I'm getting a rhythm here. And then one of these comes along. This is a teenager. It's not a saucer anymore. And it's not a plate yet either. It just thinks it's one. Wants all the privileges of a plate, but doesn't have any money. And sure has a mind of its own when you try and put some spin on it. Well, let me tell you, we are all like that. We're up against so much. We are hurried people. I wrote a book. The very first book I wrote was called Little House on the Freeway. And it's all about the hurried lifestyle. And all the, in fact, I think they have some out there in a resource center. And I studied Jesus under stress because he had a very stressful life, but he seemed to maintain this calm and this margin and the priorities. And so I studied him and found he was doing six things consistently in the midst of all the crazy things in his life. And that started my quest to look deeper into family. But I want to do, though, is go beyond that whole hurried lifestyle, because we all have that. You hurried just to get here. And by the way, there's a big difference between being hurried and being in a hurry. See, when I'm in a hurry, I'm controlling that. I'm setting the agenda. When I'm hurried, there are other forces out there pulling me headlong into the future, many times against my will and without my best interests in mind. So we have all that going. And then ministry really complicates it, because ministry is an inexhaustible cause. No matter what you do, there's always more to do. The broken and battered and the bewildered are endless. And so if you don't know how to maintain that, then it can get the best of you. And because it's such a huge calling and a huge cause, it's real easy to take advantage of the people up closest to us because, well, they're our family. They know what we're called to, and they get left behind. So I want to talk about how we can maintain that sense of priority on the people that matter most to us. And I want to talk to you about how to create a culture of grace in our homes. A culture of grace. Because when you look at standard families, Christian families, as I observe them, I find that there's a lot of well-intended but misguided things going on in the Christian home by people that don't mean to let this happen. It can happen to any of us. It may have happened to you. We've certainly gone through these issues in our own life where we find out that although we mean well, we've gotten off course. Let me put a few little categories of families that I see out there that we contend with or may even have in our own life. I see a lot of fear-based Christian families, a lot of fear-based. And they're when you hear them talk, you can just tell they're intimidated because they see how the culture is so sexualized. and so antagonistic to our belief system. They see Hollywood and the music industry working against them. They might see the school system feeling like it isn't on the same value system, and the neighbors and so forth. So the next thing you know, they keep looking at these adversaries to their faith, much like Israel kept looking at the army of the Philistines instead of looking to the God who's bigger than that army, that could vanquish it. And we look at these things, next thing you know, we're making our strategy for raising our kids and being a family based on the things that frighten us. And we got to know that this is a dead-on arrival strategy. We can never produce the kind of kids that are filled with God's power and presence when they know that we're operating from a position of fear. When I first moved to Arizona to work at a church there, this is many, many years ago. There was a very famous cul-de-sac. I called it the Christian cul-de-sac. Now, do y'all know what I mean by cul-de-sac? Come on, it's a French word. Cul-de-sac. It's a street that goes down like this, and then it circles around, and there's all these houses around it, but it's all locked in there. It's like a community inside itself. That's a cul-de-sac. Look it up. It's in the French. Anyway, so a cul-de-sac. So in other words, you get down in three or four houses, then a circle of houses. And it was a Christian. They were all Christians. These were people at the church, and they all bought these homes up there. And they said, "This is so great. We have a Christian cul-de-sac, and everybody's Christian here. And we're raising our children in this Christian cul-de-sac. And the kids, we know what's in. We have verses on everybody's walls. They come in here, and we always pray." And there's no evil cable on here and television and we have Veggie Tales and by the way, there's nothing wrong with any of these things. There's nothing wrong with creating a home that's a safe haven for your kid. But they wanted a whole community that was a safe haven for their kid because they were scared. They were scared. And Darcy and I, this is about the time we were starting to have our own children. And I thought, I would rather have my gums scraped and my eyebrows rotated then live on that cul-de-sac and raise my kids in that kind of environment. Because God hasn't called us to raise a bunch of safe kids. He's called us to raise a bunch of strong kids. And there's a different way you go about that. And I'm not saying be reckless and throw our kids to the wolves. No one's talking about that. But I didn't want to raise them in an environment where they knew all about God but didn't need him. Where they prayed, but they didn't have to pray passionately. Y'all with me? You understand what I'm talking about? Well, fear-based Christianity is all around us. And when we bring it home, it causes people sometimes to make some very well-intended but misguided choices. You see, they have the assumption, they think the gospel thrives in a controlled, safe environment. No, it doesn't. That's a false assumption. The gospel thrives when we have to lean on the power and presence of Jesus. And so, and on top of that, not only did I wanted to make sure that not only I raised strong kids, but I went to a church that saw the priority of this. And they put a high priority on equipping parents and having strong marriages. Because see, here's something else we need to know. Strong churches don't make strong families. Strong families make strong churches. And once we get that, we stop giving lip service to the whole priority of equipping our moms and dads and our grandmas and grandpas and having strong marriage. We stop saying, oh yeah, we're all for that, and then hardly have anything available to actually help make that happen. When we leave seminary, we have two marching orders when we leave seminary. We're supposed to be used of God to evangelize the world and then disciple the people that come to Christ. And I see churches that spend enormous amounts of time, energy, and budget to evangelize and disciple, but only do a marginal lip service to equip in their families. And I'm thinking, do the math. What has always been the greatest way, the most effective way for somebody to come to Christ? Have them born and raised in a godly home. That's always been the most effective evangelistic tool out there. What has always been the most effective form of discipleship? Having children raised in a godly home. Because when Christ is at home, not just at church, When he's alive and well and living passionately in that home, these kids get it and they carry it on. Besides fear-based parents, another thing I see that plagues us in our Christian homes is what I call performance-based Christianity and performance-based families. That's where parents come along, they get these kids, and the next thing you know, they're preoccupied with doing what I call sin management. But we don't want our kids to sin, and we want to keep our kids from being exposed to sin, and on it goes. It's a form of evangelical behavioral modification. It's an outside-in plan for raising your kids. And it's all about spiritual image control. You with me on that? Image control, where we prop up. We have a nice idea of what a good Christian kid is, and we want to make sure that our kids are living up to that. But that leaves us as parents and grandparents following our children around with a spiritual report card. And we're grading them all the time from right out of the blocks. And of course, they were born sinners. And so one thing they do very well is like lie and hit their siblings and throw junk and so forth. And so they don't get graded well on the front side. And your kids in these kind of homes ultimately go to one of two directions. They either work like mad to measure up to those standards because that's how their heart is wired. They want to please. They're perfectionists. They want to get it right. And so they end up doing all kinds of good things and looking very well, but for all the wrong reasons and with bad outcomes. You with me on that? They do good things for wrong reasons. Or they finally say, I figured it out. The game is fixed. I can't win this one. I'm going to save myself some trouble. I'm going to do whatever I'm going to do. I'm going to rebel through my teenage years. I'm going to stick my finger in mom and dad's eye because I can. And it just gets all ugly. It doesn't need to be this way. But there's a lot of image controlling and sin management going on when we put God on a performance basis. It brings the worst out of kids and puts spiritual chips on everybody's shoulders. Now, why would we do this? Why would good, conscientious people of faith do this? And I think it's because one of the pervasive problems I've observed in my 61 years of walking on this earth is that when it comes to God's grace, we Christians get grace. I mean, I start talking about grace and I see smiles come on people's faces. Oh man, yes, the grace of God. And what we're thinking, but what the average Christian, what they're thinking about in grace is they're thinking of saving grace. We get saving grace. You with me on that? But that's oftentimes for the average Christian where that grace stops, right there at the cross where we got saved. And we kind of stun it right there, and then we go on a performance basis with God from there on out. And we feel like, oh, he saved me. The least I can do is I need to do this for him, and I owe him. I need to pay him back for all he's done for me. And the next thing you know, we're jumping through all these hoops, trying to do all these things to continue to maintain God's favor. And maybe think if we do this, he's going to love us more. And obviously, sometimes people actually think if we don't do this, he'll love us less. And then I have to say, okay, is that what the Bible says? Does God really say in his word, if you do certain things, I'll love you more, and if you don't, I'll love you less? And of course, the answer is he doesn't say any such thing. God's love is not based on how we behave. He says it in the Psalms, I'm not dealing with you according to your sin, because if he were, we'd all be dead. He loves us regardless, and his salvation was a gift to us, not something with a price tag on it. And so the next thing you know, we have stunted the growth, the work of the gospel in our life, and we when we're thinking about grace, we tend to be thinking about saving grace and move on to performance. And this can cause us to really dial in on some major wonderful parts of the story, but by themselves can be actually turned around and be toxic. For instance, we want to know the truth of God, and we want to know apologetics, and we want to be able to defend the faith, and we want to be able to take our disciplines of the Bible and all the different areas of our study, and we become biblical brainiacs, and we're off the chart in our knowledge of it all. But listen, what difference does it make in the long run if we know the truth of the Bible back and forth and inside and out, and we can put forth the best intellectual and apologetical arguments in the continent, but our spouse regrets that they have to wake up next to us. And our children don't look forward to eating meals with us or going on vacation with us. Because you see, I love the way Chuck Swindoll said, life is making up its mind at home. And isn't it interesting when God said in his word to pick out elders for the church, he said one of the litmus tests is, does the gospel, has the gospel that they say they embrace, has it worked in their family? Does it work in their marriage? And I think what Satan does with us is he knows that if I can put a few arrows in your family, if I can shoot you right in the heart of your marriage and do damage there, I'm going to handicap all the other effectiveness you have in ministry. And that's why we've got to have a plan. We got to have a plan that works. Because you see, if I were to divide these kind of things into this kind of thinking into two categories, I think the performance-based life, I like to call it the obedience-based Christian life. The obedience-based Christian life thing. Well, that sounds actually like a good life. Well, what if in my idea of an obedience-based life, here's if my primary thing is I'm always trying to appease God. Here's where it leads to. We concentrate on being good instead of being connected to God. And this is a very human-driven, more natural, human-driven thing, and it's predictable like a march, and it becomes a performance and a duty as though it's an obligation. But it promotes fear and creates worry and guilt that leads to shame. It's very masked and guarded because you don't want to get people too close to you because they'll see the fraud that we are, that we're not really engaged, this is all an act. And so, and it breeds a critical and judgmental spirit of others and can become very exclusive. And we want to just hang around people like us in church. And it's very outside-in management and focuses inwards. But it leads to pride and self-righteousness. God has a better plan. He's given us all we need. When we take the grace that saved us, that he always meant to define us and let it wash through us, and now become the very DNA of all relationships after that. And I want to show you what that looks like, because the grace-based life, the obedience-based life is primarily focused on appeasing God. The grace-based life is focused on trusting God. We live to trust him, and it concentrates on being connected to him. It's supernatural. It cannot be done by us. It's God-driven. It's very fluid, like a dance. And the music and the rhythm changes all the time, but Jesus says, dance with me, but I lead. Dance with me. And it's a delight, as though it's an honor, promotes faith and creates calm and conviction that leads to repentance. It's a very transparent and vulnerable walk with Christ. It breeds a compassionate, empathetic spirit. And it focuses upwards and outwards, notices outwards. And get this, it lends itself to organic obedience. What's cool about the grace-based life is it leads where the obedience-based life starts. It leads to an organic obedience that comes from the inside out. And so we need to find that grace at the foot of the cross and then take it on in. And that's what I love about ELF. And coming here and getting to know the folks here, I see a strong desire to take the gospel to more than just an intellectual level, but a transforming level that changes our lives in every way possible. Well, all this said, I'll have somebody, you know, one of the pushbacks, when I start talking about God's grace, my microphone's still on? I start talking about God's grace, and invariably, somebody say, yeah, but what about truth? What about truth? And I always want to say, why would we assume that if we're talking about the grace of God, we've abandoned the truth of God? Because they are inseparable. Now, can you have the truth of God without the grace of God? And the answer is yes, you can. That was the Pharisees' problem. Nobody knew the Bible better than they did. And they stood for it with all the strength that they could, but they forgot the memo about how it was supposed to change their heart. And so they get the truth of God, right? But they miss the grace of God. But can you have the grace of God without the truth of God? And the answer is no, you can't. You can have license. You can have lawlessness, but that's not God's grace. Jesus didn't abandon it in all. Look at these wonderful verses here. In John chapter 1, verse 14, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And we have seen his glory. Glory is the one and only who came from the Father. Jesus was full of what? Grace and truth. By the way, what were the percentages of that? Have you ever thought about that? What were the percentages of the grace and the truth in Jesus? Was it 50-50? 75-25? Or did it shift based on the scenario? And the answer, of course, is it's 100-100. He was all grace, all truth, simultaneously and unending. And that's what God calls us to be. I love this one. When people resist me when I start talking about God's grace as being the pervasive and overwhelming culture of relationships, and they say, yeah, but what about the truth? And I say, but look at 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 18. But grow in the grace and the knowledge of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And it goes on to say, to him be glory both now and forever. Amen. And that Jesus, he said, we cannot represent Jesus at just the truth level, the apologetical level, the intelligentsia level. We've got to bring the heart of him to it all. One more verse on this. In Romans, as Paul is working his way through this book, there were some that would want to use the foundation of their intellect and their understanding of God's truth alone as their basis for why they feel that they should be counted in the cause of Christ. In Romans chapter 2, verse 4, look at this. He says, or do you show contempt for the riches of his kindness, tolerance, and patience, not realizing that God's kindness leads you towards repentance? So it's God's kindness that should overwhelm us, and it should start at home. And with that in mind, I want to show you a story from the Bible. Because, see, Jesus not only was filled with grace and truth, he was assigned to a grace-based family. He was brought up in a grace-based home. And we actually know about this because there are two stories of Jesus' youth in the Bible, both of them in Luke chapter 2. The first one, of course, is the Bethlehem story when he was born. And then there's another story about Jesus, about an incident that happened when he was 12 years old. And if you have your Bibles, you can follow along with me. If not, I'll just read it to you. It's familiar territory. I'm sure you've read this. And I want to pick it up at verse 39 and 40. Because 39 and 40 are two hinge verses in this passage. And what Luke does is he pulls us out of the story of Bethlehem and he transitions us into this story about when Jesus was 12. Watch this. I'm going to read it for you. Verse 39. When Joseph and Mary had done everything required by the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee to their own town of Nazareth. And the child grew. He became strong. He was filled with wisdom. And the grace of God was upon him. The grace of God was upon him. Now, what he does, he's made an overarching statement now. And the next thing he does is he gets very specific and gives you an example of the grace of God on him. Watch this. Every year, his parents went to Jerusalem for the feast of the Passover. When he was 12 years old, they went up to the feast according to the custom. After the feast was over, while his parents were returning home, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, but they were unaware of it. Let's hit the pause button for a second. If this is the first time you ever saw this story, you might be wondering, what was the Heavenly Father thinking when he assigned the earthly care of his only begotten son to these two people, that they would actually take off and leave him behind and be unaware of it? Now, I can completely understand taking off and leaving your kids behind and being totally aware of it. We've thought of doing that many times. This looks like child neglect at first glance, but then you read on, realize nothing unusual is going on because verse 44 says, thinking he was in their company, some Bibles translate caravan, they traveled on for a day, then they began looking for him among their relatives and friends. So they're moving in the large entourage of friends and family. Everybody knows everyone, and you know the rule of thumb in a large family gathering, every adult's responsible for whatever kid's nearby. That's it. You know, you're responsible for them. It might be a nephew, niece, whatever. You're responsible. And on top of that, this isn't a little boy. He's 12. You let 12-year-olds over the horizon. On top of that, this is the most responsible, reliable 12-year-old boy two people ever had. And so they're not worried when they take off that Jesus isn't within eyeshot. But then when dinner time comes and he doesn't show, they know, we got a problem. This is the boy. He's 12, and it's dinner. They show to top their tanks. Now, look. Okay, so what? Verse 45, when they did not find him, they went back to Jerusalem to look for him. After 3 days, 3 days, They found him in the temple court, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. That's an understatement. Okay, now let's put ourselves in their sandals and all for a second. It's been 3 days. You've been turning Jerusalem upside down looking for this kid. You've gone to all the places you thought he might be, and all the places you hoped he wasn't, but you knew you had to check out. The emergency room, the juvenile lockup, you know, you've gone to all the, you can't find him. It's late at night. You're in the hotel, and Mary's in bed. She's trying to get some sleep to pick up the hunt at dawn. And she's lying in bed thinking, I've misplaced God. Boy, am I going to be in trouble for this one. And then when they locate him, they realize not only is he okay, but he's been okay the entire 3 days that they haven't been. You got that? This is causing some tension, okay? And actually, in fact, it's causing two major emotions to fight for first position. The one emotion is relief, right? You feel relief. He's fine. What's the other emotion they're feeling? Anger. They're just like any of us. You just want to take him and shake him. And then you can because he's 12. There's not shaking 12-year-old syndrome. I mean, their heads are on good by then, and you can, you know, what were you thinking? You scared us to death. And Mary speaks for the two of them and said, son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been anxiously searching for you. You can just pick the passion and the angst in her voice. Jesus speaks up now. If you have a red letter Bible, it turns red right here. The first words recorded of Jesus in the Bible. He says, why were you searching for me? Didn't you know I had to be in my father's house? Now, how are they supposed to know that? You got to do a little detective work here. And there is one thing that happened prior to this that might have tipped them off. Go up there in the Temple Mount. You'll find them up there. And that is, before he even came there, angels appeared to them. Remember, angel came here and said, look, you're going to have a son under unusual circumstances. He's from heaven. And he's got an agenda. Work with him. Okay, so that's basically what he said. And so he's like saying, Mom, Dad, we sent you angels. How many people get that? Well, they didn't get it. They didn't get it. In fact, the next verse says, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. So what happened? Verse 51 goes like this. It says, then he went down to Nazareth with them and was obedient to them. But his mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus grew in wisdom and stature, and there's the word again, favor, grace, with God and man. Verse 51 is a superb example of a grace-based family in action. You say, how so? Well, you see, it says he went down to Nazareth and was obedient to them. He did not give his parents grief. He responded to their leadership, and he was submissive to them. And on top of that, look at this. It says Mary treasured all these things in her heart. Now, last time I checked, you treasure something you value. But the verse just before that says she didn't understand what was going on. And two verses before that, she was yelling at him. So this doesn't look like a scenario you would value, right? And see, what we're seeing here is they're responding differently under the stresses of life than most people do in our default mode. That's a grace-based family. They're responding differently because they're operating in God's grace. You can see grace by what didn't happen. Joseph could have said, Jesus, you are so grounded, it's unbelievable. Don't plan on going anywhere or having a personal life for a long time. I'm so angry at you. He could have said that. Come to think of it, Jesus could have pulled some fairly serious divine artillery out about now himself. He just says, excuse me, but I think you've forgotten who you're dealing with here. How about I refresh your memory? You know, it was me who came up with that original idea, let there be light. I made you. I made the gravity that's holding you to the ground, the air you're breathing. I could write out the code of your DNA. I know how many hairs in your head. You don't even know what I'm talking about. But you're not going to tell me what I can or can't do. He had the authority to say that, but he didn't exercise it. Because he was responding to his earthly guardians in grace, and they were responding to him in grace. They had the same kind of tense situations we do, but they responded differently. And that's what grace does. God's grace, when it gets the best of us, it overwhelms us with his power and presence, and we respond differently. Let me give you some examples of this, some very specific examples. In fact, let me show you something. When Darcy and I started having our kids, we didn't want the fear-based plan. We didn't want the performance plan. And so we started looking for the theology of family in the Bible. And unfortunately, there wasn't one in any of the books that I read. I went to Dallas Seminary. They have theologies on everything, but there was no theology on family. There was some great passages like Deuteronomy 6 and Ephesians 6 and Colossians 3, but no theology of family. And yet we kept praying, the Lord, it's not like you. It's just not like you to go and give us this kind of responsibility and not show us the way. And then we had one of those aha moments where we realized, wait a minute, God is a parent. He's a father. We sometimes call him that when we pray, right? We're his children. And we thought, wait a minute, I wonder if we could take what God is doing with us as a parent and quantify that in such a way that that becomes what we do with our children. And that's how we came to this, what we call the grace-based plan for parenting. And we've actually distilled it down to a whole house model. If you can put that one up there for them to see. Because, you know, a house represents like where we live. And we found that God's grace comes at us in four levels in the Bible. He's always dialing in on our inner needs. He sets our hearts free. He builds our character. And he's always aiming us at something bigger than life, at true greatness. And I define greatness as a passionate love for him that shows itself in unquenchable love and concern for others. And so with that in mind, you can break this into parts, and we did, and you can't read any of that, but I'll show you how you can find out about that. But there's the individual parts. And I'm going to dial in on the second level here before we're done here. I'm going to show you what that looks like, what the four freedoms look like. And by the way, we come here. All of us come here together because we want to kind of cross-pollinate spiritually and learn things. And we have all these resources. And so they told me to mention to you some of the resources we have. And everything about the grace-based model is distilled from three books that are out there. And they're called Grace-Based Parenting. In fact, you can put that one up there for them. Grace-Based Parenting, Raising Kids Who Turn Out Right, and Raising Kids for True Greatness. And that just kind of unpacks it all. But if you want to know more about us, we have a website that we're constantly putting stuff on. It's filled with all kinds of information and help to strengthen your own home and help you as you minister to other families at familymatters.net. Start following us on our blog and our Twitter, and we would love to become an ally and an asset to what you're doing. And then we've taken all of this grace-based parenting plan, and we have a conference we do on it in U.S., but it's on DVD, and we've brought those along here too. And you, if you're interested in that, in something that you want to actually go and unpack, a grace-based plan for the people that you work with, it's out there. You can get that, or if they run out of those, you can just you can get it through our website and download on it. It's very inexpensive, and hopefully it'll raise your stock value many times over. All right, so with that in mind, let me dial in on the freedoms, and then we're going to have some time for prayer. Watch this. When I look at God's grace with us and how he deals with us, there are four freedoms that he consistently gives us as a gracious God, and we need to give them to our kids. First freedom that grace-based families have is they give the people they love the freedom to be different, to be different. That's the first word you want to fill in there. Now, when you say different, that sounds pretty safe. Let me give you some synonyms for different so you know what I'm talking about. Ready? Weird, bizarre, strange, goofy, quirky. Grace-based homes have room for those kind of kids. In fact, they celebrate those kind of kids. Fear-based families do not have room for those kind of kids. Sin management homes, evangelical behavioral modification homes, performance-based homes have no room for weird, bizarre, strange, goofy, quirky kids. And so right away, we're contradicting the very heart of God when we don't make room for them. Now, why is it that weird, bizarre, strange, goofy, quirky kids are sometimes hard to have around? Well, because they embarrass us. Say, stop that. Why? Because you're embarrassing me. Or stop that. Why? You're annoying me. They annoy us. They embarrass us. But why? Because you have little children. You have little boys, right? You get a little boy, and you have your Christian friends over, and he's out in the backyard. What's he do? He does a headbutt right into a tree. Boom! And hits a tree with his head. You think, what are you doing? And then he goes and does it into a wall. What are you doing? And it's a little boy. They're weird. How about little girls? You have little girls? They have imaginary friends. And they're always talking with their imaginary friends. Give them anything, they will give it a human name. They name everything. They personify everything. Give them little Barbie dolls. They play a TV show. And like one of those talking shows in the mornings where all the women are sitting there talking, and they always have like a conservative and a liberal, and they argue with each other, and they're fighting and so forth. And they talk. And then the son comes along, and he picks up the Barbie doll. What's he do with it? He bites the head off and throws it like a grenade. He makes explosive sounds. The kids are weird. Then they become teenagers. They become teenagers. They go over, your son goes over, your 14-year-old goes over to a friend's house. The friend gets out his dad's weed whacker, and he cuts your son's hair with it. And then they get into their mother's medicine cabinet, get out her hair coloring, and they mix it all together, and they do something that's a shade of blue, green, pink, stuff like that. And they spike it out, and he comes home, and he walks in and shows you his new do. And mom looks at him and says, I don't think Jesus would be very pleased with your haircut. We say these kind of dumb things. We do. We actually say these kind of goofy things. I don't think we got to go for the heavy artillery as fast as we can. Forget the fact that we're breaking one of the big 10 there, using God's name in vain. Because Jesus, I read the Bible through every year, and I was having to referee some major fights between parents and their kids over hair for a while when the hair was really wild. And so I thought, I wonder what the Bible actually says about hair. So I put a little bookmark in the front there when I started, and I'm just reading, just keep an eye out for what God has to say about hair. And I read the whole Bible. And here's basically what God has to say about hair. I don't care. It's your hair. Have fun with it. Express yourself. Use it like a lab experiment. And some of you might want to grab the chance while you can. Because it's going to bail on you. He doesn't care. You say, what about that 1 Corinthians 11 and shame? That's about worship. That's about proper propriety in worship. Not talking about these kind of arguments we're about. So I don't think Jesus would be very pleased with your hair. And so and when we say those kind of things, we throw a wedge between that kid's heart and us and that kid's heart and God. Because God doesn't think that. He doesn't care. Now, by the way, can you have arbitrary rules in your home about hair and stuff? You know, what does he have to say about style? Be modest. That's all he has to say about it. By the way, does he define modesty in the Bible? Does he specifically spell out what the modesty is? And the answer is no. We have to ask him to lead us on this. You know who does spell out modesty in our world? The Taliban. They spell it out. That's what a nightmare can become when we get legalistic like this. And so we can have arbitrary rules. Just don't make them moral issues because they're not moral issues. Don't make them biblical issues because they're not biblical issues. We have a son named Colt. Colt was going into junior high. Is that right? Junior high, like 7th, 8th grade. I don't know what you all call it over here, but 7th, 8th grade. He's going into junior high, and he asked me at the beginning of the year, Dad, can I grow my hair real long this year? I said, give it your best shot. You're going to have to grow it real long before it's as long as mine was when I was in junior high, because I was a junior high in the 1960s. We had really long hair. And so he grew this nice long hair, and he's a tall boy. And at that time, he was already over 6 feet tall, and he had this beautiful hair. Well, I was speaking at a church in Miami, Florida, and I'd actually got done speaking, and I was in the taxi heading back to the airport to fly back to Arizona when my phone rang, and it was Colt. He called and said, Dad, it's spring break. I said, I know, we're going to have a lot of fun. Dad, I was wondering, can I have a mohawk? Can I have a mohawk? You all know what a mohawk is? You know? You cut the sides, and I thought, maybe he's going to grow up to be a worship leader or something. And I thought about it. I said, yeah, sure, that'd be fun. You can have a mohawk. I said, listen, son, I'll be home about 7 o'clock. We'll cut you a beautiful mohawk. You can have it all week, but we have to buzz it off on Saturday because your school doesn't allow mohawks, mohawk haircuts. He said, okay. So now, when I hung up, you got to know, I was factoring in something in my math. I was factoring in church. I'm going to be home Sunday night at 7. Church is over. We're cutting it off Saturday. Everything's fine. He hung up the phone, and our daughter Shiloh was listening. Said, what did Daddy say? He said, I can have one. He gets home, he's going to cut it for me. She said, I know how to cut one of those. They got out the clippers, and she cut him a mohawk. They took Elmer's glue and glued it up. And he went to church that afternoon at 4:30. Now, we go to Scottsdale Bible Church, and it's a big metropolitan church, a mega church. There are thousands of people on our campus. And so he goes to church with his big mohawk. And I'm sure it just sucked the air out of some people's lungs. And they had to step up the medications on some. And I don't doubt that there were some people that looked and said, isn't that the son of the guy that writes the books about parenting? But there was one man who in between the two services was out, and he saw Colt. And he looked over at him, and he got his attention. Colt Kimmel, get over here. And it was our senior pastor at the time, Daryl. He was our senior pastor, and he saw Colt. And Colt came over to him. He was looking at him because he's so tall. And he said, Colt, that's a magnificent, that's the best mohawk I've ever seen. How do you get it to stay up like that? Glue. And he went on to say, I wish I had a camera to take a picture of me and Colt Kimmel with his mohawk. I put it in my study. Because you need to know something. This is very important. We took our children to a grace-based church. It was the only church we wanted to raise, the only kind of church we wanted to raise our kid in. We wanted to take our children to a church where the people running it know what matters and what doesn't matter. Because when people look at the external things and draw conclusions, that isn't how God works. Because what does it say when Samuel went to, anoint a king at Jesse's house, and he saw all these strapping, wonderful men, and he said, no. And then finally, he said, do you have anybody? And then David came in, the runt of the litter. I mean, he was out there, and Samuel was right, you got to be kidding. And I always picture David, in today's idiom, I picture David as a bit of a, kind of metro, and, skinny jeans and the big rings in his ears, and he's humming because he's a musician. He's got junk in his head and all that stuff, and he, that's the kind of person he was. But he is also somebody that took God seriously, and you don't mess with him. When you start insulting his God, it's going to cost you. And when Samuel saw him, you got to be kidding me. And God said, don't think like men. Men look on the outside. God looks on the heart. And see, our pastor knew our son's heart. He was a good kid. He loved his parents. He loved Jesus. He worked hard in school. He was a good friend. He was a good sibling. He looked at him and he said, Tim, wait a minute. Couldn't there be, what if somebody's really falling apart on the outside? Couldn't that point to some problem on the inside? And the answer is, of course it can. Often it does. But does it make any sense to attack the outside if that's your son? Or your daughter? Because the outside is just a symptom of the problem. It's just a symptom. And to attack the outside is going nowhere. Remember, it's all about the heart. You get the heart right, and the outside takes care of itself. If the heart's right and the outside's weird, who cares? What does it matter? Because God doesn't care. They're fun. They're arts and croissants types. Don't worry about them. They'll be fine. They'll grow up to be fine. Grace-based families give the people they love the freedom to be different. I love in Proverbs 22:6, it says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Thanks to the exegesis of Chuck Swindoll, he says that when you take that Hebrew apart, you render it best. He says, train up a child according to their unique inner bent, and when they're old, they will not depart from it. In other words, find out the inner wiring of a child and work with it from there. Grace-based families work with their kids that way, and they give them the freedom to be different. Secondly, grace-based families give the people they love the freedom to be vulnerable. To be vulnerable, meaning they don't have to wear masks. They can verbalize their doubts and fears. Their vulnerabilities can come to the surface without fear of them being attacked. Your kids don't have to have a guarded heart or a secret heart around you. They know that their heart is safe with us. I'll give you an example from my own life. I was going into grade 10. We call it high school. Maybe you'll call it high school here. Going into high school. Excuse me, not grade 10, grade 9. Going into high school, and I was very excited. Because the high school I was going to go to was in a town called Annapolis, Maryland, and I loved it because it was a great big high school, and I was going to play football for their famous championship coach, plus the girls were prettier, the rock and roll was louder, there was more of both. I thought, this is going to be great. I'm going to the big high school. But that summer, between my 8th and 9th grade, several hundred of us incoming 9th graders got letters from the Board of Education saying that because of overcrowded conditions, we were being annexed to an elementary school, in a primary school in downtown Annapolis. And so instead of going to the big high school, we're going back into primary school. And there were many trade-offs. Probably the biggest one was in the area of physical education, because normally for phys ed class, what you would do is you would put on a phys ed outfit and you'd go out and play, do whatever you're going to do. And by the way, it's a very humid area, and so even if you sweat, no problem. You come in, take a shower, put your school clothes back on. We didn't have that option. We had to do everything in our school clothes. There was a gymnasium on the 2nd floor of a building, a county building, a couple blocks from the primary school, the elementary school. And I went in there one winter morning for phys ed. And I got very excited when I walked into the gym because there was a trampoline opened in the middle. I got very excited because I'd never jumped on a trampoline before. They weren't pieces of equipment in backyards or anything back then. So I got very excited. Well, the phys ed coach came out. We all gathered around, and we all gathered around the trampoline. He went and he looked around at all of us, and he came back to me and said, "Kimmel, take off your shoes, leave on your socks, climb up here, and follow my instructions." So I pulled my shoes off, and I climbed up, but as I did, I realized I had holes in both of my socks. Not one, both. And one of my friends thought everybody should know this. "Oh, look at Tim's toes sticking out. Isn't this sad? We need to take up a collection, buy Tim some real socks." Now, by the way, were that to happen to me now at my age, I could care less what people think about how I look or whatever. But when you're in that corridor of time, that 13, 14, 15, 16, that's a time when children are unusually self-conscious. And this became a very embarrassing moment to me because it was like he was putting down my family's economics. And we were lower middle class, meaning we didn't miss a meal, we paid our bills in time. But we always felt, get as much mileage out of your clothing as you can. And up to that point, I thought it was a good idea. Until I was up there and I was jumping and doing exactly what the coach was telling me to do, but all I was thinking about was my toes sticking out. When I stood down, I was sitting there thinking, I'm going to go home, I'm going to get out my sock drawer, and I'm going to darn every pair of socks. I will never let this happen to me again. Well, the other guys jumped, and then when the class was over, the coach dismissed us, and he took off. I went and got on my shoes, and I went over and got my books off. There was a stage at the end of the gymnasium, and I went out the side door, and I got down the bottom of the steps. I hear my name, "Kimmel, wait up." It was the PE coach. He came down, he pulled me aside, he says, "Hey, Tim, I want to tell you why I called on you to do the demonstration. Tim, you're the most agile student in my class." And then he reached down, and he pulled off his tennis shoe, had a big old hole in his sock. And he's wiggling his toes, he says, "You know, us agile guys are tough on socks." Now go to class. So I'm heading over to class, and the whole way I'm thinking, what's agile? Because I'd never heard the word before. I was a pathetic student. I didn't know, but I was going to an English class, and they had these big dictionaries, and they loved it when you actually looked up a word without a gun held to your head. So I went over, and I looked up agile. Now, I'm glad I didn't find argyle. That would have really confused me, but I found agile, and I read for the first time in my life that I could move with speed, ease, elegance, and liveliness. I read for the first time in my life that I was mentally alert and quick-witted. No one had ever told me that before. I wrote it down. And I memorized it. And I did a 180-degree turn in two major areas of my life: academics and athletics. In fact, a couple weeks later, they had a challenge. Who can do the most sit-ups in the 9th grade? Now, by the way, they weren't these crunch things you do now. You can do millions of those. They were these things that are now illegal in our public school system. They don't allow them to do it because they tear your back out. And where you have to lay down flat. And they didn't even know at that time if you bend the legs, it takes a little pressure off the legs. They didn't know that then. It's so long ago. And so anyway, they lay down flat. Somebody had to hold your feet down, which, by the way, hurt like mad. And you had to come up and cross over and touch the opposite knee for it to count. I set the record that year. I did 560 of those. I sat up through phys ed class, through English class, and through lunch. I just kept sitting up. They were sending out runners. He's up to 201, 20, you know, 300, you know, all that stuff. I sat up and did 560. My stomach muscles hurt for days after that. But I didn't care because I was agile. You know, it took me a while to put all the pieces together to figure out why the coach disappeared so quickly after class. He had to get off to his little office, get his shoe off, get the scissors out, cut the hole in his sock, put the shoe on, and chase me down. Because he didn't go around with holes in his socks. He's a PE coach. They get new shoes and socks as part of the deal. But he saw an agile kid that needed help. And he touched his life with grace. Now listen, I want to tell you something. Our children have and grandchildren have these kind of moments all the time. All the time. Someone has defined adolescence, childhood, is a 24-hour day, 7-day a week, 365-day-a-year battle to keep from being embarrassed. They need grace waiting for them. We cannot marginalize or trivialize or write off the things of their heart, even though they're young and they might be into drama and all that stuff. We got to understand that. So when, let's say you have some kids in grade four, and he's home and he's moping around the house, and he's just not being himself. And dad finally says, "What's wrong? You know the girl at school, Becky, that I really like her. Well, it turns out she likes another guy, and she pushed me down, and I just feel really bad. She doesn't like me anymore." Let's say dad, I'm going to exaggerate him to make a point. Let's say dad says, "That's what this is all about? You're holding our family hostage over a silly little puppy love. This isn't even a puppy love thing in fourth grade. You don't even know what love's about. You can't even date till you're 16. Now listen, you cowboy up. Don't do this anymore to us. You get it. You change your attitude." I mean, you know, I'm exaggerating to make a point. Let's say that happened. Here's what the boy would think in his head. Note to self. Don't ever bear your heart around this man again. It's not safe. Listen, God, in his grace, prompts us to be transparent and open to him. And he never marginalizes us like that. And we have to be careful that we use his grace properly with our kids. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 9, where Paul had a thorn in the flesh, and he was very vulnerable about this. And he took it to God, and each time God says, he wouldn't take it away, but he says, "My grace is sufficient for you. My power is perfected in your weakness." Colossians chapter 4, verse 6 says, "Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone." Everyone. So grace-based home give the people they love the freedom to be different, freedom to be vulnerable. Let me give you a third one. They give the people they love the freedom to be candid. Grace-based families give the people they love the freedom to be candid. Meaning that we need to give people we love a respectful outlet for telling us what's on their heart, even if it's something we're not excited about hearing. For instance, what if they go through a period where they're just doubting all the things that matter most to us about their faith? Say, "Look, I'm sorry, but I don't buy it that the Bible is God's word. I don't buy it that Jesus is the only way. I don't buy it that Jesus is even God's son. I have a real problem with this." This isn't a time to panic and hire some theologian and duct tape them to your kid's face until the kid gives up or something. Smarter kids than yours and mine have questioned these kind of things. In fact, this might be a vital part of their spiritual journey. They need a loving, calm parent that just stays alongside them, doesn't worry about it, but lives out God's faith passionately in spite of the fact that kids are doubting. What about this one? What about if you've messed up? Does your kid have an outlet to talk to you when you've ticked them off? Because we certainly have an outlet to talk to our children when they frustrate us, don't we? We just let them know right away. But is that a two-way street? Because unless we're perfect parents, and none of us are, we make mistakes. We get it wrong. Do they have an outlet? Isn't it interesting that in Hebrews chapter 4, it said we have a great high priest that was tempted all in all ways like we are, yet without sin. And then he goes down in verse 16, he says, Therefore, let us approach the throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. He knows what we're going through. He wants us to come to him, even if we're frustrated with him. And so do your children have an outlet to come to you and say, "Mom, Dad, I am just so frustrated and exasperated right now. My heart is just filled with frustration. And the way you're talking to me, or the way you deal, or what you did, is that it? And now, they've got to do it respectfully. Of course they have to do it respectfully. The one way we can raise a chance they do it respectfully to us is we speak respectfully to them when we're frustrated with them. I have a son named Cody. Cody's in his fourth year at Dallas Seminary, but he was once a boy in high school. And one night, one spring evening, he was finished his homework, he was going to bed. And he said, Dad, I forgot. I need you to call me out of school tomorrow at noon, at 12 o'clock. I need you to call me out. And I said, really, why? He said, because it's opening day of the Arizona Diamondbacks. That's one of our baseball teams there in Phoenix. And he says, it's opening day of the Arizona Diamondbacks. And my friend Steve has got tickets right behind the dugout. And he's invited me to go with him. And me and Steve go in the opening game. Now, by the way, you need to know something else. The year before, the Arizona Diamondbacks had beaten the New York Yankees in a World Series. This is a big opening game. For some stupid reason, I felt like I needed to teach him about personal responsibility. I said, Cody, you're a student. Students go to school. You don't get out till 3. I know, Dad, but they're going to have F-16 jets fly over at the beginning. Well, that'd be very nice, but you have a job. I have a job. We go to work. You don't get off. But, Dad, I think Randy Johnson's going to be pitching on the mound. Well, that's wonderful. And I went back to personal responsibility, trying to talk to him about, you know, we have to be ready to go. And he said, but, Dad, I think Alice Cooper's going to sing the national anthem. And the poor kid, and I kept coming back, and you could just see, and finally he got real quiet. And he said, Dad, listen, I bring you home straight A's. All I've ever brought you home are straight A's on my report card. I can't bring you home any better grades than I'm bringing you. Now you need to decide whether I can go to that game. It was like a hand came right down out of a cloud and did one of these right on the top of my head. And then, what's your problem? Sign this kid out of school. What are you doing to him? And what's really ironic is me teaching him about personal academic responsibility. Because those grades he made were from his mother's side of the gene pool, not his father's. I struggled in school. I never made straight A's. I always felt you should have vowels and consonants on your report card. See? Look, Dad, it's like one of those games. Find a word. I see like 4. How many do you see? I reached in my pocket, and I took 2 large bills out of my pocket, and I handed them to him, and I handed him the money, and I said, Cody, make sure you buy the big hot dogs and the big drinks for you and Steven, and please forgive me for being such an idiot. Now, you know, the memories of youth, they fade as you get older. There's so much of our childhood experience that just dissipates in our memory. And this may be one of those things that dissipates and he forgets happened. But you know what? If I'd have stuck to my guns and refused to sign him out, he'd have never forgot to the day he died. What a moron he got assigned to for a father to take a stand on something so ridiculous. But we had already put in place in our home that they had the ability to candidly talk to us. When they were little, we started a thing called What's Your Beef Night? And that's where they could order anything they want off the Kimmel menu, and they could go around the table and say anything Darcy and I had done to them that ticked them off or embarrassed them or frustrated them, and here's all we were allowed to do, and that's ask for forgiveness. We weren't allowed to put it in context or explain away, because they said, no, that's not going to work. We just ask for forgiveness. Grace-based homes give the people they love the freedom to be different, vulnerable, and candid. Here's some great verses on candid too. And look at this one. Hebrews 12:15. See to it that no one misses the grace of God and that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many. So give them the freedom to be different, vulnerable, candid. The last thing, grace-based families give the people they love the freedom to make mistakes. To make mistakes. Now, I don't mean by that we're encouraging them to make mistakes, nor do I mean by that there aren't consequences for when they make mistakes, because grace is not a lower standard, it's a higher holiness. Grace disciplines kids, because grace loves, we say, I love you too much for you to grow up to be a fool or to waste your life. I'm going to discipline you and correct you. In fact, once again, in the Word of God, it says, Hebrews 12, verses 5 and 6, my son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens. He chastens. And I was reminded of this one Saturday morning. My daughter Shiloh was just a little girl. She was like 5 years old. And she shook me awake. And she said, Dad, it's time to wake up and go on our date. I had promised her the night before I'd take her out on a breakfast date for Saturday morning. And she'd gotten up and got ready. But I looked over the clock and said, honey, it's still dark outside. And she said, but Dad, I did my hair for you. It was all snarl. I picked this outfit out for you, and I'm looking through the darkness. It's all mismatched, but I knew where she wanted to go was open because it was a convenience store that's open 24 hours a day, every day of the year. They're called Circle K's in Arizona. They're all over the place. Every other corner, they have a convenience store, and that's where she had told me she wanted to go. So I thought, oh, okay, then no problem. Let's get up. Let's go on our date. So we got there about dawn. And I went in and she picked out a couple of donuts and some juice and I got a cup of coffee and I paid for everything. And then we went out and we sat down on the curb on the side of the convenience store to have our little date. And we're sitting there, me and Shiloh here. And then over here was a dumpster right over here. You know, a big garbage dumpster. But it was far enough. We're over here and we're safe and we got our food here. And we're just visiting right there at dawn. And I'm letting her set the agenda. And she wanted to talk about the Sleeping Beauty video that we had gotten for her, the Walt Disney movie. And she was just jabbering away about Sleeping Beauty. And I said to her, honey, what's your favorite part of that movie? She said, Dad, I love the part at the end when the handsome prince and Sleeping Beauty dance together in a castle. And I thought, that's my favorite part, too, because I'd watched it with her. And I don't know what provoked me to do this, but I decided to reenact it. So I put everything back in the bags and the lids on everything. I picked Shiloh up there, and I started singing that song and dancing with I Know You, I Waltzed With You Once Upon a Dream. We were just waltzing away. And as I came around, there was a little field right behind the thing, and right across, there was a home right there, and it was a row of homes, but there was a guy, and I could see a man at his breakfast table looking out at me as I'm dancing, and the thought crossed my mind, he's over there stirring his coffee, calling his wife, quick, look, there's an idiot over at the Circle K, dancing with a little girl next to a dumpster. But another thought crossed my mind, then in a very brief period of time, some young man was going to come along and tap me on the shoulder and say, Mr. Kimmel, may I cut in? And he was going to waltz her out of my life for good. Turned out his name is Ian. A wonderful young man. And that childhood just went faster than we ever imagined. And it is with your children too. The Latin term is carpe diem. Seize the day. And we need to seize it with grace. We're going to go to some time of prayer for, I think it's optional or whatever, they can pray. But if you want to have prayer for your family, maybe to start off ELF, we might want to just go and spend time with somebody and just put our kids, our grandchildren, our marriages. Look, marriages go through seasons. We get married in the springtime of love, and we hope it's that hot summer love. But the fact is we have autumn seasons of our marriage. We have winter seasons in any marriage. Whatever, we want to pray for you. Alexander, come on up here, and thank you all for letting me talk to you.